programs that you enjoy. If you're not a financial supporter of the station, this would be a great time to do it. If you could call us at 244-9455 and make a pledge, that means send us some money, help pay the bills. If you could, just at the basic level, which is $40, that would be great. If you could do a little bit more, well, that would be also great. You can decide that. But here, this is the last weekday of our fall fundraising effort. The last time here this morning, at least on Focus 580, we'll be talking about supporting the station. And if you've been thinking about it, if it's been on your list of things to do, why don't you do that this morning? And we do have a special kind of an incentive to offer for people who will make a pledge this morning during this hour of Focus 580. For anyone who is able to call in and make a pledge at the $75 level during this program now, so that means between now and 11 o'clock, Dave says that he will give you a 15-minute private consultation. So there you go. Maybe you've been listening to this program for a long time and you listened to Dave and you thought to yourself, gee, wouldn't it be nice to back this guy into a corner and say, okay, look, here's my situation. Here are my questions. What do you think we should do? And he will do that. 15 minutes, one-on-one kind of deal. You can talk about your specific concerns, and he'll do his best to give you some advice for a $75 pledge. So when you call in, 244-9455, just do tell the volunteer that you're wanting to take Dave up on this offer, and we will do that. And we hope to hear from lots and lots of folks this morning. Well, having said that, we want to say good morning and welcome and happy to have you here.
Well, good morning, David, and it's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to participate in the laudable goals and objectives and the fundraising at WILL. You know, as always, there are a host of financial topics that we could discuss, but I would like to take just a few minutes this morning and discuss something that probably is on a lot of people's minds, and that is current interest rates and their likely future direction. And you know me pretty well. I'm generally not a prognosticator, but I'm going to kind of go out on the limb just a little bit this morning, give you a little background about interest rates and talk perhaps about their future direction, relying on some people who know a lot more about this topic probably than I do. First, some very brief history. You know, it was approximately, well, about a year ago when interest rates were very close to their 45-year historic lows. For example, the prime rate hovered at 4%. The prime rate, of course, is the base rate on corporate loans posted by at least, well, 75% of the nation's 30 largest banks. And the Fed funds rate was at 1%. Now, recall that the Fed funds rate is the rate banks borrow overnight from each other in order to comply with their bank reserve requirements. The Fed funds rate is actually a target rate and is set by the Federal Reserve System. And, of course, the Federal Reserve Chairman is Alan Greenspan, who is often referred to as the second most powerful man in the United States. We often hear in the media the term monetary policy, and one element of monetary policy is the actions of the Federal Reserve with respect to its lowering or increasing this target Fed funds interest rate. Now, monetary policy, of course, is in contradistinction to fiscal policy. An example of fiscal policy is raising or lowering income tax rates. And, of course, both monetary and fiscal policy actions are taken in order to stimulate or slow economic growth in the United States. Now, it doesn't take a Philadelphia lawyer to figure out that when it becomes more expensive for banks to borrow money from each other overnight, banks are probably going to pass on that additional cost to us, we being the customers or consumers. And indeed, that has been precisely the case thus far in 2004. So far for this year, the Federal Reserve has acted three times to raise the Fed funds rate from historic lows of 1% to its current target rate of 1.75%. And of course, banks have raised their prime rate from 4% to its current 4.75%. Now, these changes have translated into higher borrowing costs for consumers, especially with respect to car loans and second mortgages, or even lines of credit, which are very, very similar to second mortgages. Interestingly enough, in spite of this 0.75% rise in rates this year, home mortgage financing is still very competitive with 30-year fixed-rate mortgages, oh, in about the 5.25, perhaps as high as the 5.5% range. Also, investors are somewhat pleased as 5-year CD rates and 10-year Treasury rates now approximate about 4%. They were as low as 3 to 3.25% about a year ago. Now, obviously, the question astute investors and our listeners at WILL are asking is what in the world's going to happen to interest rates in the fairly near term, and particularly after the election? Now, we know that Alan Greenspan has signaled to investors that more Fed fund rate increases are probably on the horizon. But what does that really mean? How much? When? Why? Now, some of the best commentators really are talking about interest rates moving higher. And some of the best strategic thinking in this area has been articulated by PIMCO advisors and Bill Gross in particular, who's really sort of the titular head and the guru of interest rates when it comes to thinking about these things. PIMCO is probably the largest professional manager and advisor of bonds in the world, managing literally hundreds of billions of dollars of bonds. And their website, if you're interested in just looking it up and hearing what their kind of thinking is on interest rates, is www.pimco.com. And incidentally, I have no pecuniary interest in PIMCO. I wish I did. That way I wouldn't have to constantly ask David every 3 or 4 months for gifts for helping my kids through college. I'm still waiting on those gifts from David. Maybe he's making more donations to the station. But in any event, that's the website, www.pimco.com. Clearly, they have an outstanding track record, and I wanted to share a little bit of their thinking. Really, their most recent thinking is based on some seminars that were held in San Diego, California during the past 3 weeks. And these seminars were private seminars and really for investment advisory firms, managers, and very wealthy clients of PIMCO. And basically, they feel that the Fed will continue to raise the Fed funds rate and certainly at least another 0.25% later this year post-election. And next year, they are also looking for the Federal Reserve to continue these increases, especially if monthly job growth would start to approach or exceed 150,000 jobs a month. That seems to be their magic number. Looking at that job growth, and if job growth would essentially increase, and remember, it's been constraining now for a couple of months. It hasn't been very exciting. But if that job growth starts to grow again, PIMCO sees the very real possibility that the 10-year Treasury, which now is about 3.98% or 4% on a yield basis, they feel pretty strongly that it's going to approach 5%. So that's a big move. That's 100 basis points. That's a full 1% on the Treasury. And then PIMCO claims that they will become a net buyer of Treasuries. So that's an interesting piece of news when the largest bond players in the world, essentially, of U.S. bonds, believe that, one, interest rates are likely to continue to move up, especially next year, and, two, that they become a buyer at the 10-year Treasury level when the Treasury hits close to 5%. They believe that this scenario will play out if two major economic elements don't change. First, if the balance of payments deficit doesn't significantly improve from its current $45 to $50 billion deficit per month. What is that all about? Well, in a nutshell, we're importing about $50 billion of goods more than we're exporting on a monthly basis. That's a negative balance of payments, and in some senses, that actually is inflationary. And it is becoming a major problem. It's about $600 billion deficit if this number continues, which is about 6% of our gross domestic product in terms of the total goods and services, thinking of about a $10 trillion number. And second, if the federal deficit doesn't contract, in other words, if it doesn't get smaller, how likely is that? Both parties are big spenders. It doesn't matter whether we're Democrats or Republicans, liberals or conservatives. Let's face it. We're all pretty big spenders, and whose fault is that? We have nobody to blame but ourselves, including myself. So as we see more and more federal spending, and we don't see dramatic increases in tax revenues, I don't see that federal deficit particularly getting better. I think it's only going to get worse. We're now at a $7.65 trillion deficit and growing every day. Some people are estimating that we're running a budget deficit now close to $1.5 billion a day. That's a nice number to add to the federal deficit. So PIMCO feels that if these things don't improve, that holders of U.S. Treasury instruments will demand higher returns for holding our treasuries in order to continue to hold them. And also, PIMCO is projecting the dollar to drop in value against the euro from its current exchange of about $1.26 American to $1 euro. And believe me, I'm understanding that concept quite a bit as my daughter is studying abroad this semester in Spain. So it's not like the old, here's an American dollar and I guess I get a euro. No, I've got to put up $1.26 American to get one of those dollar euros. And PIMCO thinks that that spread could move even more dramatically to $1.35 to $1.40 American for a dollar euro. That certainly is not good news for people traveling abroad perhaps as early as next summer. And keep in mind, this kind of move on a currency market is actually inflationary for the U.S. economy because our imports will become more expensive, which could further raise interest rates. So what does this all mean? It seems to me if you are sitting on cash or money market funds and are really getting tired of 1 to 1.5% returns, here's my advice. Exercise some more patience. You may see 2% money market funds around the corner sometime in the second quarter of next year. And keep your eye on the 10-year Treasury. It's quoted in almost every financial journal. And when the 10-year Treasury is getting close to 5%, that's the time to start buying fixed income. Start buying CDs and moving out of money markets. So there you have it, David. That's sort of my thinking on interest rates this morning. I'd be delighted to further explore this question or any other financial topic of interest to our listeners. We could talk about REITs. We could talk about recent journal articles on insurance scandals that are now seeming to be at the forefront and having a major impact on certain Dow Jones Industrial Averages, stock market averages, etc. All these kinds of concepts, topics I'd be happy to talk about.
All right. Well, people who are listening, you have questions, just pick up the telephone and call us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so that if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, calls on us. That's 800-222-9455. Our guest is David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I and is here on the program once a month. It's always on a Friday to answer questions about investing in money management. And again, we're hoping that people will call in and pledge to the station this morning, but that's an entirely separate thing. It's a different phone number. You just want to call in and talk with Dave. You're certainly welcome to do that. And maybe, you know, I should mention, for those people who are keeping a score at home, they're saying, wasn't last week, last Friday, the day that Dave was supposed to be here? And I have to admit, yes. In fact, it was. And our apologies to go out to Dave and anybody else who was disappointed last week when he wasn't here, because I'm afraid we just made a mistake in our scheduling and somehow thought, you know, this was the one. No, you're right. Last week should have been it. But we're certainly glad to have him here in any case. And I know that there are people that do very specifically tune in, and they expect you to be here on the right Friday. So for all those folks, well, I'm sorry, we got that goofed up. But your questions are certainly welcome, and we get some people here already lined up, starting with someone right here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good morning. This one's kind of just for fun. Sometimes the quote-unquote markets feel very strongly about a Republican or a Democratic president. Do you think that there's any expectations or will there will be dramatic changes in the stock market if one or another of the depending on who's elected?
You know, it's a great question. It's been looked at, and there have been a lot of articles written even in the Wall Street Journal about it. A lot of people are arguing, interestingly enough, which seems to be different than old thinking, is that a Democrat would be better for the market than a Republican.
Oh, good.
And a lot of people think that's they're going back to the Bill Clinton era, where markets were very, very strong until the end of the Clinton administration, where people might argue that it was already moving into recession at the time George Bush took over. My personal opinion is that it isn't going to make a heck of a lot of difference. And maybe in the short run, the first two or three trading days, we might see some more volatility after the election. But I really don't see that much of a dramatic difference. I think the real issues that are going to be facing these gentlemen, whoever wins, in addition, obviously, to international terrorism, is issues of the deficit, issues of balance of payments. These things are going to have dramatic impacts and
right.
funding the kinds of programs that they're talking about funding. Where in the world are these dollars going to come from?
Right.
And it's both parties. It's both parties.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
My
All
pleasure.
Right.
It's a great question.
The next Thank caller you. Is in Des Plaines up in the Chicago area, line four. Hello.
Oh, yes. Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Listening to the show and enjoying it. Missed you last week. Would like to know, do you have an opinion concerning second home, summer home, real estate, and the impact of some of the things you're speaking about? Because I sort of feel real estate is always a local and location oriented, and I wondered what you're feeling about the strength in those markets for second homes.
Number one, there have been, again, a lot of people on both sides of this argument saying that are we approaching some kind of real estate bubble? And indeed, if we are, is this an appropriate time to buy? I think if you are buying a second home as an investment, then I think you want to be very, very careful about how much you're going to spend and where you're going to locate that second home. Are you interested in it more as an investment or actually as a potential retirement type of area?
I would say for the next 2 years more, I'm going to need the investment aspect of it. Beyond that, no, then it would be for personal use exclusively.
Okay. So if you are really going to purchase the home as an investment, then I presume that you're going to be in the rental property business. Is that the idea?
It would be the first time for me, yes.
Okay. So one of the issues, of course, the moment that you go into the rental property business is one, location, and two, management. And are you intending to manage this yourself?
I don't believe this is a minefield. I don't feel strong enough to do that. I'll probably need help.
Okay. Well, I think then it's extremely important that as part of this decision to buy this second home is to investigate very, very carefully the management opportunities that go along with that second home and locating a firm that is in the business of managing second homes in the area where you are desirous of buying. Have you located a geographic area?
Yes. This would be northwest Michigan.
Okay. And, well, I've got to applaud that choice.
Oh, okay.
I think that's one of the stronger places in the country to be buying is in Michigan. I think Michigan will continue to be strong, and while prices have escalated, they haven't escalated nearly as compared to certain other hot spots in the country.
Mm-hmm.
You're not too far away, even though probably to get there by car might be difficult. You probably have to go around or go south and then go north.
Yes, that's right.
So that will take you some additional time. But I think that is one geographic area of the country that does make good sense. And I would caution you not to be tremendously leveraged in that kind of product.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are going to mortgage the property, then I would urge you to get a fixed interest rate financing, even though it's a second home. Those rates are still extraordinarily competitive, and as opposed to a variable rate loan where we might get into a situation where interest rates are moving higher, and then you find yourself in a bit of a pickle.
Yes, that's one of the things that that would have been my follow-up question. So fixed rate, although higher than some of the adjustables at the moment, it with inflation around the corner or some kind of inflation, it does make more sense to go fixed, even if it's a little bit above its more recent lows.
Right. And then the other thing I would remind you about, that the minute you go into rental property, it's important that you have appropriate levels of umbrella liability insurance.
Oh.
And I generally recommend that for anyone who has rental property, that that umbrella liability should be at least $2 million.
Mm-hmm.
So that covers your exposures not only at your personal residence, in your automobile, other people driving your automobiles, but as well at the rental property. So that becomes extremely important. It's another expense, probably adds $200 to $300 per year in terms of your insurance costs.
Okay. Very good advice as usual. Thank you a lot.
Thank you for the call. Well, we have a couple of other people here waiting. Others are certainly welcome to call. Our guest is David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I. Once a month, always on Friday, he's here and we talk about money management. It's an opportunity for you to call in and ask questions suited to your specific financial situation. Now, many times on this program I've said, we want you to think very carefully before you make these decisions. Get as many opinions as possible. Do your research. Do your homework. This is one place you can get one sort of set of answers and one set of advice. And so I would hope nobody would go out and stake their retirement just on what Dave says. But this is one resource, and we built it into the schedule because we figured that people would always have these kinds of questions. And Dave's been in with us for a long time, and then for many years we had a local financial planner named Marilyn Nichols, who also did this show. And again, it was this idea that we wanted this to be a resource for you. Now, in return, we're asking for a little something on your part. And it's in the manner of an investment. It's a pledge in WILO. And we think about it in the investment terms in this sort of a way, that it will, for your investment of, let's say, $75, your return, the programs that are here on this station every day, almost half of the money that it takes to run the station comes from listeners. And if you are a supporter already and have been for a long time, well, we want to say thanks. And I know there are people, I'm sure there are people listening this morning who are. But if you're not, this would be a great time for you to sign on during this fall fundraising effort. And it would help us a lot, help keep the station strong. 244-9455 is the number to call. Let me do that more slowly. 244-9455. And 217 is the area code. Jack Brighton is here in the studio with me.
Hello.
Hi.
I would stake my retirement on the advice of this man, David Sinnoh, but I don't have anything to invest, so it's kind of a moot point. But I did want to add something, that David has come here to do the show once a month for, these many years. This is a guy, he's got an MBA, he's got a JD degree, he's a certified financial planner, he's got so many other qualifications that we don't really have time to list them. And he can speak in plain English and does a great job of explaining very complex questions in very simple terms, very understandable. And that's something that's incredibly valuable. It's great to have expertise, but if the person can't communicate, then it's no good. David can communicate. We hope that you get a lot of value out of what he brings to the show and that you will give something back to the station to keep that going. Again, the pledge line, 217-244-9455. You can also make an online pledge if you're listening on the internet or you just happen to have a browser open in front of you. Go to our website, will.uiuc.edu. Make a pledge. And we have a very special offer for this hour. Let's let's go to Rita Schulte, our membership director, who's with the phone volunteers. And let's hear some noise back there. And Rita, what's going on?
Well, we have callers on caller on phone number one. Phone number three just hung up. We do have plenty of volunteers back here to take your call because we have a very generous offer from David Sinnoh. For anyone who calls in at the $75 level or above, which incidentally is the member card level, during the program, that means this hour only, they will receive a 15-minute private consultation with David Sinnoh. Now imagine, this is your fantasy. You've got a financial question or a problem and you just cannot figure out all by yourself. 15 minutes with somebody like David Sinow can mean a lot to you.
We should add by telephone.
By phone,
a telephone consultation, yeah.
Yeah.
Make it clear.
Yeah, telephone consultation. And that $75 means a lot to this station as well, because we'll be able to continue to bring experts like David and the others to you on a monthly basis. Now, Henry's taking a call, and Kathy is, and they're all responding to David's generous offer of this $75 exchange for 15 minutes on the phone by yourself, just you and David Sinow.
Right, and plus you get the member card. Mm-hmm. And you get the good feeling knowing you're supporting the station for a year. $75 works out to, I don't know, I forget exactly the math, something like 17 cents a day or mm-hmm. something like that. So your pledge call right now at 217-244-9455. Only until 11 o'clock this morning will this offer be valid. So we hope you'll pick up the telephone now.
Yes, indeed. Well, thank you very much, Rita and Jack. And thanks to everyone who has called already. And we hope that you'll just keep ongoing, so we can make the goals we've set for ourselves, and then, of course, that larger goal of just keeping the station strong. Well, now, here we have some other callers to talk with on the air, and we will do that, of course, we're about midway through here, and so we'll get in as many people as possible. If you have a question you'd like to talk with Dave, just call us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The next caller in line is, I believe, in Indiana on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Oh,
yes.
I gave money last Saturday doing that two-hour media program, put a little pressure on that 90% out there. My question deals with banking facts, I guess. When the money is passed back and forth, I guess, quote-unquote, between the different banks and the feds, and the interest rates that are charged, are those paid at that time of the going back and forth, or is there some sort of deals made, or how is that exactly done? And if there's any other kind of things like that in the finance world, could you say something about it? I know when I read the Wall Street Journal, I see certain things, and I often wonder, just like that, is that done right then, or is it done, you know, end of a fiscal year, and they take care of, you know, pluses and minuses or whatever. Thanks.
Well, that's a great question. Actually, it's done on a daily basis. In other words, most banks, if not all banks, belong to something called the Federal Reserve System. So the Federal Reserve has what's called the Fed Wire System. It's basically a bank of computers that keeps all of this straight. And as you know, at the end of each day, banks are required to have a certain amount of reserves on hand. Now, sometimes they have excess reserves on hand. Maybe they didn't make the kinds of loans they thought they were going to make during the day. Or alternatively, maybe they have a need for excess reserves due to money going out of the bank or whatever. So toward the end of the day, we get into a situation where we have excess reserves, which means that we've got money that's just sort of, if you can think about it, dancing money in the vault that's gaining no interest for the bank. So the bank is obviously wants that money loaned out. So what they do is they loan it to other member banks, and it can be a negotiated rate. And usually smaller banks will have relationships with larger banks and have either lines of credit or have the ability to borrow this money overnight. And it's important that these relationships exist already prior, because a overnight loan from one bank to another is an unsecured loan. So if I'm Bank A and I'm going to loan money to Bank B overnight, that's an unsecured loan. So I want to make sure that Bank B that I'm loaning that money to is secure at least overnight. And that 1.75 target rate that the Federal Reserve has set is the target, sort of the rate that ends up at the end of the day. But during the day or before that target, that rate might be slightly higher or might be slightly lower between all of these member banks. Now, do dollars actually cross the table? Does someone actually deliver dollars across the table, kind of like a waiter at dinner would deliver you dinner? No. This is all done through the Fed wire. It's all done across computer, and banks are credited or debited amounts of money on a daily basis. Hope that clears that up.
All right. Let's go next to a caller in Gifford, line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I have a question. My husband and I had purchased some residential lots in Florida 30-some years ago, and they have finally really escalated in value.
Congratulations.
Yeah, it took a long time.
Was this in the Cape Coral area by any
chance?
No,
this is Northport, located in between Sarasota and Fort Myers.
Okay, great area.
And anyway, our question is, we were looking at the possibility of a 1031 exchange into probably farmland property here in Champaign County. I guess one of my questions is, or if that doesn't work out, whether we should consider, you know, going ahead and contracting for a home on a few of our lots and translating all of the equity into one and then selling it. Do you have any idea of what the, I've been told that the Northport area is one of the faster growing areas in the U.S. Do you have any information on that or any advice you can give us?
You know, I'm sorry, I don't have anything off the top of my head. Obviously, it wouldn't be that difficult
right.
to do some internet searches, to do as well as talking to real estate associations, et cetera. Tell me how many lots you have.
We have four.
All right, you have four lots.
Mm-hmm.
And you're telling me that they have dramatically escalated in value?
Yes.
Have they gone up maybe 5 or 10 times since your purchase price?
Well, let's see, we probably have, I think right now we're realizing an 8% increase in the time we purchased them.
Okay,
original purchase price was around $1,600. They're selling in a range of from $20 to $30, and most of that has occurred since the end of last year.
So from $1,600 to $20,000 to $30,000.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you obviously have a long-term capital gain.
Exactly.
So you have basically three or four different choices. One is you could obviously sell for cash and pay capital gains tax.
And what would that be right
well,
now?
Well, you got to remember that capital gains tax at the federal level is 15%.
Okay.
All right?
Uh-huh.
So you would pay that. And Florida has no state income tax, so you wouldn't be charged any capital gains tax in Florida on those sales. So that's a choice. And 15%, is the capital gains tax rate ever going to be lower? Probably not. Probably not. I don't see it moving much lower than it is currently. So that's a choice. A second choice might be to hedge my bets and say, you know, these things have gone up. If we're in a fast-growing area, they're probably going to go up some more. What a wonderful return. Compounded is 8%. Let's hedge our bets and sell half.
Uh-huh.
All right? Hang on to half and sell half. That's often advice I give to someone when they can't decide on what to do with the stock. I said, well, you're going to be half right or half wrong, but bottom line is you'll probably be reasonably happy.
And that was a choice. The only, let me enter one other factor.
Yes.
They have not at this point done a lot of infrastructure as far as the drainage and sanitary, et cetera, et cetera. So we are trying to balance to where we would like to perhaps try to realize our profit before we have to pay in a lot for the improvements that, since my husband's a civil engineer, he can foresee someday at the rate it's growing and expanding would be a reality.
Okay, so you don't really want to face those assessments.
That's one of the
All
things
right.
we're thinking about.
And again, I think you need some professional advice down there to see what happens vis-a-vis the cost of those assessments and then what typically will happen to the value of those lots.
Mm-hmm.
It's just impossible to say, so I really hesitate to
even
guess about that. The third choice, of course, is to find a buyer, to locate a buyer for those lots, perhaps a developer, perhaps a contractor,
et cetera. We're receiving three and four offers, you know, a week almost.
Well, if you're receiving three or four offers a week, that tells me that there is dramatic demand and limited supply. And when you have dramatic demand like that and fixed supply, my economics professors used to tell me that price ultimately goes higher. So if you're having that kind of response, I would be hesitant to sell all of those properties today. Okay, that would just be me off the top of my head with that kind of demand structure and that kind of demand curve. On the other hand, if you do find a deal that you like and you have, so it sounds like you can be easily accommodated on the sales side, you can locate property through a 1031, even maybe something called a Starker exchange, where you locate property up here, you take the proceeds from the sale in Florida and you place them in a trust. You don't spend them, you don't have them made out in your name, and then you have that buys you some additional time to essentially locate and close on property up here. But you will need the help of a competent attorney who is very understanding and discerning of starker exchanges, how to handle them. But that's what you would probably be looking at. It's called a starker, S-T-A-R-K-E-R, exchange.
Okay.
So that's really my advice. But I'm thinking, just from what you're telling me, and again, you really need to do a lot more research. I would be hesitant to just willy-nilly sell all of them, especially when you have that kind of demand.
Okay? Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you for the call. We'll go next to line number one. This caller is in Urbana. Hello.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've got a related question. I have a friend who has a farm in southern Wisconsin, and he has a very good offer for the land for development. It's over 10 times what his cash basis is. He's thinking of buying more land in McLean County. The land value there has gone up dramatically, too. And I'm wondering what you think of this strategy.
Well,
I think the value of the land in Wisconsin is about $10,000 an acre.
So he's getting development value for the land.
Yes.
Sure.
Yes.
Because I think in southern Wisconsin, even high-quality southern Wisconsin land is about $3,000 an acre.
Yes.
That is not development land.
Right.
So he is obviously getting the premium of development land. And then he would be desirous of taking that money and obviously exchanging into other land.
Yeah, as I think about it, under $1,000 cash basis.
Okay, so obviously he would want to exchange because he would end up paying probably, well, at $1,000, that's a $9,000 gain. So he would be looking at $1,350 per acre just in tax plus state of Wisconsin tax. He is a resident of the state of Wisconsin.
Yes.
So he would also be looking at state of Wisconsin income tax, so he could easily be paying $1,600, $1,700 an acre in tax. On the other hand, what a wonderful problem to have is to own land that is now worth $10,000 an acre. My question would be is why would he be going to McLean County as opposed to locating other land in his area?
Well,
I don't have a problem with the exchange itself and the notion of the exchange, and McLean County certainly is top-quality land, and you're going to pay top-quality prices, but that's okay. But it was a different question, and that is there not similar land or similar types of land that can be exchanged in his county or in his area?
Actually, it'd be as expensive as the land in McLean County, believe it or not.
Well, okay. Well, if that were the case, then they're putting a premium on that land in Wisconsin because of future development or the tourism attraction of Wisconsin land.
Well, this is in the Lake Geneva area.
All right. So is this land currently in the Lake Geneva area?
Well, actually, it is inside the southern border of the city of Elkhorn.
Okay. I'm familiar with Elkhorn. I used to go as a kid.
Yeah.
With my mother to Elkhorn, and there's some beautiful lakes around that whole area.
Very much so.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful area. I think, I guess I would have a threshold question. Is $10,000 per acre enough?
Well, it seems to be. There doesn't seem to be that much land. That's the highest offer he's had. I have the same question, but...
well, again, we're just sort of speculating, but my feeling is that obviously this would be an exchange situation. He's going to do this. He probably is not going to recognize the gain and pay the tax. So he would do some kind of exchange.
That's what he's
and
done in the past.
Mm-hmm. Number one is $10,000 given the area that he's located in and the continued profusion of growth in that area, is that enough money? And two, if there isn't similar land, if the land is just as expensive as McLean County, I'd vote for McLean County.
Mm-hmm. Well, I kind of think so. I was just wondering your opinion. Actually, holding on might not be a bad alternative, I would suppose.
Well, that's what I'm asking. Is $10,000 enough?
Yeah. It's probably the highest he could get today, but I wonder, too, if it won't accelerate more rapidly in that suburban area than it will in McLean County, although McLean County apparently is almost 50% higher than it was 2 or 3 years ago, which seems incredible.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question that someone called in off the air, and I'm not sure how well, we can respond to it, but I'll ask it and see what you say. Someone who's just interested in having you talk a little bit about some of the pluses and minuses of investing in energy stocks, and mention specifically Provident, Enerplus, PWI. And I know you don't go in for recommending specific stocks. And in fact, I'm not sure that you're even a big sector investor. But I don't know. What do you think?
Well, there have been a lot of people who have been sector investors in the energy play recently, and a lot of people are now dumping their energy sector stocks. They're thinking that oil at $55 a barrel, if not at its highs, is close to its highs, and that when oil starts to fall, you're going to see some of the profitability be essentially drained out of some of these major oil companies that have been bid up dramatically over the last 6 months to a year, where they've reached their 12-month highs. So one, I'm not a believer in individual stocks, so I have no comments about Provident. In general, it might be a wonderful stock. It may triple, quadruple, but I have no opinion about it. And as far as a play, if I was going to be in energy stocks, I would certainly be in an energy mutual fund, and I would certainly have no more than 2-3% of my overall portfolio in any one particular sector.
All right. That's kind of the kind of answer that I would expect, having listened to you now for so many years. And again, for the caller, I hope that that's helpful. Next, we'll go to another caller here, and they are on the campus, line number 3. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a philosophical question. And recently in the News Gazette, there was an ad for a seminar taught by a local financial planner. And he was addressing the conventional wisdom of putting lots of your retirement money into 401ks, 403bs, IRAs, and paying down your mortgage on your home, and he was of the mind that this was not a good strategy because ultimately you're going to have to pay more taxes. Did you see the ad, or are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
I have seen the ad, and I'm also familiar with the gentleman who is an excellent financial advisor and financial planner. I have not been privy to the information in his seminar. Let me say this. With reference to 401ks, number one, I've always advocated that you make certain that you put in at least enough money in your 401k to maximize any match that is offered by the company. So, for example, if the company says you must put in $2,000 a year into your 401k before we will match $1,000, you would be leaving $1,000 on the table if you didn't put $2,000 in out of your salary. So to me, I can't think of an argument that would make any sense. So number one, I would urge people to maximize their 401ks to make certain they receive the maximum dollar match from their company. One of the assumptions in any retirement planning is what income tax bracket are you going to find yourself in when you start pulling money out? And it is entirely true that there are a lot of folks out there who, when they are retiring, they have monies from pension funds, 401ks, 403bs, and Social Security. And Scott Burns has written about this. There is no question that a number of people who thought they would find themselves in a lower income tax bracket, in fact, find themselves in a similar, if not identical, tax bracket while they are working. So in terms of this powerful argument about saving tremendous amounts of money because you're going to be in a lower tax bracket, sometimes it doesn't work out that way. And just in terms of my own specific experience over the last 25 years, it's rare where I've seen someone in a lower tax bracket at retirement. And it is hurtful when you take money out of a 401k or a pension fund and you're sending 25% or more to the government. Nevertheless, there is appropriate places for 401k programs, 403b programs, because don't forget it's also forced savings. It's great to say I'm going to take my money and do something else with it, but you know what happens? If it isn't whisked out of your paycheck, somehow it goes for pizza, it goes for movies, it goes for discretionary spending, and it gets eaten up. So it takes a tremendous amount of discipline for an individual to save outside of sort of these forced retirement savings programs. In addition, I strongly advocate the use of a Roth IRA. And most people are eligible to participate in a Roth IRA because they don't make enough money. In other words, if you're married filing a joint return, you've got to be in the $160,000 or more category not to be able to participate in a Roth IRA. That's taking after-tax money, investing it, and then accessing it at retirement, no tax, no tax on the gain. So I would urge people to take a Roth IRA. As far as paying down quicker on your mortgage payment, part of it is psychological. Part of a lot of people feel better if they are hammering down on that mortgage. And I advocate very strongly that one of the most important things that you must have taken care of when you retire is no more mortgage payments. You don't want to have $500, $1,000, $1,500 a month going out on your mortgage when you retire. It's just too burdensome on your cash flow. So I think there are a number of arguments on both sides of the matter. There is no one right answer for any one individual. But certainly it piques people's curiosity. And as I say, the gentleman who's holding the seminar is well thought of, well respected, and probably has some very good ideas.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Try to get at least one more caller. Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
In keeping with the fact that this is a fundraising drive, maybe you could, and thinking also about the number of questions you've had about what to do with selling real estate, we will be thinking about that sometime soon. And I'd like you to talk about the advantages for some people of doing a charitable, is it a charitable remainder trust where you don't end up being charged for the capital gains, et cetera, and you can end up with an income, et cetera. Maybe you could explain that for people and me.
Sure. There are basically a number of charitable tax savings devices, charitable annuity trust, charitable remainder trust. But basically what happens is that you are essentially taking an asset with a substantial capital gain in it. Maybe it's an income property, maybe it's a major stock, and you are donating that to a charitable organization. When you donate that, you don't sell it. You've actually conveyed the asset to the charity, and thereby you don't pay the capital gain. So if you had a stock that you paid $10,000 for and somehow it had escalated to $100,000, if you sell it, you would be responsible for paying the capital gain on $90,000, which might be between federal and state income tax, somewhere in the neighborhood of $15,000, $16,000. On the other hand, if you donated, gifted, conveyed that asset to a charity, they immediately then would be the owner of that asset. They would sell that asset. Charities don't pay tax. And they can arrange it for you to receive an income from that asset. So in other words, you would receive maybe 5, 6, 7% a year based upon your life expectancy, based upon your ages. Not only do you receive a tax deduction for making the initial contribution to the charity, but in addition, you would receive an income from that asset. A portion of that income would come back in the form of principal. A portion of it would be taxable income. So it's a win-win situation for people, especially older people who are saying, you know, I have this asset. I don't really want to sell it because I have to pay tax, but I'd like to really earn some substantial income from it. So that's really the mechanism. Some of these are called charitable annuity trusts. Some of them are called gift annuities. There are different ways to set these up, but they basically all accomplish the same thing. You don't pay the tax. Indeed, you get a tax deduction based upon your age and your life expectancy, and you get an income. And then, of course, at your death or at your survivor's death, then the remaining value of that gift stays with the charity for their charitable purposes.
All right. Well, we're going to have to stop. And I'm sorry, we have some people we can't take, but we've simply exhausted our time. We want to say thanks to Dave Sinnoh for being here. And I promise again that next month on Friday, he'll be back. Should be the third Friday. Right, third Friday. So mark that on your calendars. We'll see if we can get that right this time around. And it'll be another opportunity for you to ask questions. David Sinnoh, clinical professor of finance at the University of Illinois.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. We also want to thank the Art Mart in Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana, for providing some support for this program. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Thanks also go to Body Work Associates. This year, celebrating their 22nd anniversary, Body Work Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982, and also has been for a while now, for a long time now, a supporter of WILL. And we hope that we'd like to count you as one of our supporters, you who are there listening, sitting in front of your radio, or no matter where you happen to be. If you haven't made a pledge of support to the station, this would be a great time to do it. It's the last opportunity we have to talk to listeners of Focus. And also, you have this chance to get on us on this offer of a consultation with Dave Sinnoh for a $75 contribution. Jack Brighton is here in studio with me.
Right. If you call the pledge line right now, 217-244-9455, make a pledge of $75 or more, you will receive a 15-minute telephone conversation, a consultation with David Sinnoh, our guest this morning. In addition to the member card and all the other benefits of being a member of the Friends of WILL. So call that pledge line right now. Just 4 minutes left in this offer. So 217-244-9455. Let's check in with Rita Schulte, our membership director. How are we doing?
Jack, we're doing well. We've heard from 8 people who are willing to take David up on his offer for the 15-minute telephone consultation at the $75 level or above. We want to encourage you to get in on that. We have 4 more minutes. Once 11 o'clock hits, that's it.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, that's 2 hours of David's time, and I know it's not doesn't come cheap for him.
No.
So, I mean, that's a significant commitment on his part. And there are a couple lines ringing. Let's get some more going right now, 217-244-9455. You just have about 2 minutes left to get in on this.
And when you, if you make your contribution at the $75 level, we will also happily send you a WILL member card, which will entitle you to 2-for-1 entrees, some discounts at shopping, some discounts at stays at bed and breakfast. It's a real windfall. You can make up way more than your $75 with this card. Our way of saying thanks at the $75 level as well. 217-244-9455. You can use your credit card. We take Visa, American Express, MasterCard, and Discover. Now, Jack, if they're listening to us on the web, we will go check the web page and make sure that all the calls that came in the 10 o'clock hour will be counted at the $75 level as well. And our web address again is will.uiuc.edu if you want to go there right now. But it's got to be before 11 o'clock.
All right. Well, Thria, thank you very much. Jank, mm-hmm. Thank you very much. We're going to take a little break here, as we usually do. We'll have news from National Public Radio in Washington. We'll have an update on the markets. When we continue, we'll be talking about the shootout at the OK Corral and something that I'm sure most people don't know about, and that is that afterwards, Wyatt Earp and his brothers and his friend, Doc Holliday, were all put on trial for murder. That's the subject of a book we'll be talking about with Stephen Labette. He's a professor of law at Northwestern University. So hope you'll stick around. Right now, though, we have an update on the markets.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets. In that corn pit, technical selling and bearish fundamental influences are keeping the market bulls at bay, at least at the moment. Let's go ahead and look at the current tick